I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, a few months ago, Parallax Views put together a series of episodes on Medicare for All and health justice in America as part of a healthcare fundraiser for a family hit by medical expense woes after a freak accident befell their father. The GoFundMe set up by that family has since raised over $17,000 of its $40,000 goal. As such, the fundraising efforts are still ongoing. And with that being the case, I decided to release some previously unpublished material from the Parallax Views Health Justice fundraiser. First up, a conversation with Elliot Rosenstock, author of Zizek in the Clinic, a revolutionary proposal for a new endgame in psychotherapy. If you haven't heard my previous conversations with Elliot, get ready for a whirlwind of a ride. Elliot is warm, entertaining, funny, philosophical, and has a lot to say about healthcare in America as a practicing psychotherapist. And with that being said, let's jump right into the conversation with Elliot Rosenstock, author of Zizek in the Clinic, a revolutionary proposal for a new endgame in psychotherapy. Welcome back to Parallax Views, the illustrious Elliot Rosenstock, author of Zizek in the Clinic, a revolutionary proposal for a new endgame in psychotherapy.
Yes. Hello.
Elliot, I wanted to have you on because I'm doing this for a sort of fundraiser episode of Parallax Views. We're helping a GoFundMe for a family in Pittsburgh whose father was in a very bad accident, C7 fracture, and he's paralyzed from the chest down. It's dark stuff, and his Medicare recently ran out, so he's not covered right now, but he needs this treatment. And I guess I just want to talk to you about your thoughts on the whole healthcare issue and maybe some of the stuff you're working on now. What do you make of healthcare in America right now, though?
Well, the problem with the will to health, you could call it our collective will to health, is The Hegelian lesson is it turns into its radical sort of opposite in various times. And I guess when people need the actual healthcare, they're sort of ignored by virtue of there's so much rhetoric regarding client care and, oh yeah, we really want to help people. But of course we have a system that doesn't allow that. And I'm very familiar with the insurance industry in general, and I've gotten into heated arguments to the point of not talking with the head doctor of Blue Cross, former head doctor of Blue Cross, regarding single payer healthcare. And the idea is it's a very self-righteous idea. It's like, well, we've worked so long on this neoliberal health insurance sort of process that the idea that we need universal healthcare rather than just expanding the private healthcare system. The thing that Americans are going to contend with is this fetishization of the way things are in terms of just capitalism and a sort of basically anti-socialist and anti-union and anti sort of anything which is for the collective good in order to like systemically change, which would be sort of like any sort of drastic change seems to be difficult to get through just the massive amount of money which is already invested into this healthcare system, which is causing a man to need a fucking GoFundMe with Elliot Rosenstock. Oh my God. God forbid. To fix his spine. I'm glad you already have $5,000, but yeah, that's idiotic. It's absolutely idiotic.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, you know, it's just the system as we have it now, the sort of neoliberal view of how healthcare should be arranged in this country. It's just bizarre. I know you said anti-socialist, but beyond that, it's just straight up anti-social. I mean, you know, you hear responses to people who are having healthcare woes, and they're like, well, it's your fault. That's the neoliberal response. It's your fault. Maybe you should have done yoga or exercised more. It's your fault. It's your fault. That's always seems to be what it comes back to. And, I mean, in the case of this family, the Wessel family and their father, George Wessel, I mean, this was just a freak accident that left him paralyzed. So I don't know how that's his fault. Maybe he should have just not gone outside. It's your fault that you went outside and an accident happened. I don't know what neoliberal centrists and Democrats, what they want.
Look, it doesn't matter what they want. What we need is a revolution against them. And it needs to be as effective as we can make it. And it needs to happen. We can't try to convince neoliberals that they're wrong. We just have to, you know, we have to beat them. You know, we have to declare war, and we have to, not necessarily an actual war, since like it is like this sort of symbolic order production that we're trying to fix. Whether, you know, I'm not against actual war. I just don't think that that's a viable tactic regarding health insurance in America. But I think we just have to have that mindset where it's, this is the enemy. We need to get people to recognize that capitalism has no morality whatsoever. I don't think it's even I don't even necessarily think. I think the worst part is it doesn't blame him. Of course, no one would blame him. And I think the people that are oppressing him, and in terms of making him turn to GoFundMe, would agree with you. They'd be like, "Oh, sure, that makes sense. God bless," you know. Oh yeah, of course he should have health insurance. Really sad that this happened. You know, let's see what we can do. We can't really do anything. Man, this sucks. This machine that I'm operating, oh, it's just the worst. You know, the problem with capitalism is everything is superseded to generating capital. That's the problem. And if you can't overcome that overcoming, then that is the task of like a socialism or a communism or an anarchy, I would say, even in these times. It's like there's the real of capital, and the real of capital is causing these results, and we simply need to beat the living shit out of it any way we can. And yeah, it's difficult because it is such a networked design in terms of there's no single point of failure. So it's just it's a very difficult task that we have ahead of us.
It reminds me of I know we've both read a little bit of Nick Land, especially early Nick Land, and you know, when I think about stuff like this, I'm like, you know, Nick Land's whole metaphor of capitalism is like this self-assembling terminator that just sort of devours and destroys everything in its path to create and generate capital instead of providing for human needs. It's pretty spot on.
Yeah. I mean, the question, if you root for it or if you kill it, it's like there's no not killing it. There's no compromising with making money. You have to have a superseding value of human life above generating capital at the expense of generating capital. And I think that's what people don't get. They're like, what? You can't do something that's at the expense of generating capital. It has to do both. That's, you know, that's what people always say. It has to do both. You know, I don't know if they say that exactly, because that would be a lot of insight. I think they more act that way. Like the whole idea of overcoming capitalist realism is such a difficult thing to overcome. You know, that's the issue with it. And people are so desubjectivized, you could say, in our modern sort of society, in terms of as political subjects or as subjects who have any sort of agency to change anything systemic, or, you know, we sort of have this reactionary subjectivity in that we're encouraged to participate in sort of flowery nonsense. I had a great conversation with someone who was anti-union, who was like this, who was a sort of, you know, activist type. It's like, I feel bad, you know, because, you know, usually I support this, so I support activists, I support causes, is essentially the thing. It's like, man, and I'm not supporting the union, I'm not signing because I'm like, you know, I don't want to like get on the bad side of the bosses, blah, blah, blah. And, but I feel really bad about it. And I didn't say this to them. I'm like, you should feel fucking bad about it. You know, this is, you're inhabiting this subjectivity, which is altogether, you know, reactionary. It's worse than reactionary because it's sort of crypto reactionary in that it has a mask of progressive values, but its real is reactionary. It does not fight the systemic changes anywhere that it will have any effect. And that's the problem with progressivism as such, as it is today.
I was going to say, you know, even something as slight in a change as, say, social democracy, social democratic policies, even that is opposed by neoliberals. Oh, we can't be like Scandinavia. Bernie Sanders, very, very bad. No, we can't have that. And
We live in a reality show where people care about, oh, which representative is going to be, who's going to be fucking the Bachelor, which is like essentially what the president of the United States is now. It's like, who's going to be, is it going to, don't get me wrong, maybe Bernie could do something if he got elected, but, you know, it's really like the conversations I hear of people that are like supposedly political subjects are like concerned with like the minutiae of what their representatives are saying, which is, it's like, you know, there's no theory outside of that.
Well, how do you think the healthcare and the Medicare for all and this whole debate around, you know, health justice, essentially, how do you think it ties into sort of what you're doing with psychotherapy and Zizek in the clinic? Maybe you can give a Lacanian take on this kind of thing.
A Lacanian take in terms of the virtual. Well, the problem of, you know, the object cause of our desire is it's intrinsically virtual, is the Lacanian point, in terms of it's this intersection of the symbolic or the law with the fantasies about it. And I think, you know, a Lacanian take could be the fantasy has become the symbolic, in so far as the symbolic is this sort of pseudo-representationalism that we live in, right? So if the symbolic and the imaginary are sort of stuck in this parliamentary democracy mindset rather than focusing on systemic changes or even focusing on what you personally can address, you know, I'm not a don't act think kind of guy. It's like, you know, there's nothing wrong with actions. That's not an either or, you know. I think maybe it's against the blackmail of taking stupid bad action. But then if you find it stupid or useless or pointless, just say fuck no. I'm not an. That's what I say. You know, it's like I examine a situation, and if what I can do has an impact, I do it. You know, if I determine, you know, it's something that is good.
Well, go ahead.
Within my framework of leftism. Oh yeah, well, just wait till you see what the next Zero book is going to be. Speaking of Lacanian takes, it'll...
You got something in the works for us, Elliot?
Oh yeah. I got the ego, the sort of more developed ethical and psychological system of egoism, which hasn't been done yet. It's the egoist ethical system has sort of been overlooked. I think Stirner did the best job, but it's far from like a good systemic work. It's more, you know, the creation of ways to sort of disregard the symbolic order. And I think the thing that's in the work is the first really good systemic unification of psychological and ethical egoism in post-left subjectivity or anarchist subjectivity as it relates to the left and the state. So, yeah, that's what's in the works.
Well, I'm curious, what have your experiences been like in sort of mental health and how it could relate to these healthcare issues that people have financially and whatnot? Maybe you can give a little insight.
Well, it's like, you know, Foucault said, you know, is it any coincidence that hospitals resemble prisons? Or prisons resemble hospitals, but usually the way that's framed is like, oh, the hospital is a prison. But it's very rarely sort of acknowledged that mental health clinics are created in this sort of open floor plan. Is it any coincidence that a mental health clinic is arranged like a fucking factory? Just like any other factory. You know, it has bosses, it has the sort of layout of workers, it has the same sort of modes of exploitation. The whole idea that any sort of will to health can sort of break through this, this sort of, you know, this, the capitalist sort of feudalist dynamic is yeah, an individual can, but systemically there are so many things which interfere with this actual sort of, you know, the clinic actually focusing on mental health. Like the whole idea that you could have a, like imagine if we had a clinic that, you know, people just sat and they learned about mental health and they had this really good knowledge built of what it means to be a therapist, but that doesn't happen because what happens is this is how you bill. Half the clinic is billing. Everything is sort of focused around like how do you interact with insurance? How do you interact with the monetary end of it? That's what people care about. The fact that I'm a good therapist is almost like that is so secondary to things that people are concerned. People like think that's interesting. It's like, oh, it's interesting that, you know, clients who, you know, they really didn't want a male therapist or they didn't want a white therapist or they seem to instead of just exiting if they get assigned me, they seem to like come back. That's like a curiosity. It's like, oh, it's curious that your clients are like getting, you know, it's like, that's kind of funny. It's almost like humorous because it's so irrelevant to the fact of the main purpose of the clinic is this sort of monetary generating machine. In terms of like, I remember advocating for something for client care and they said, and then the head of where I work goes, it's like, well, you know, monetarily it could also be good because it saves us money in the long run. I said, yeah, but the main thing is, you know, it's better practice, right?
Right, meeting the needs of clients.
They sort of laugh. They're like, ha, that too. Like, that's like secondary. That's sort of like the joke, the disavowed joke, which is like, you know, the client care is really secondary in terms of like, you know, so much energy is given to billing and generating capital. And, you know, as much as people like me, workers, want to focus on client health, the fact of the matter is capital is designed to self-replicate. So the people who get stuck in the agency that would have an ability to determine what's going to happen tend to be people that have that neoliberal mindset of like, yes, we like to help. And then in practice, just absolutely just the most brutal capitalism that you can imagine. There's no difference between, you know, a Trump capitalist and a neoliberal capitalist. There's no woke capitalism. There's only capitalism. Like, yeah, they'll use woke signifiers maybe, but it's like to call it woke capitalism is sort of like a misnomer. It's just like they determined it was capitalistically advantageous to have a Pride Month logo or some shit. You know,
well, like
Coca-Cola in there. The tweet, it was kind of funny. It was Coca-Cola. Did you use a singular pronoun? Did you use they? Yes, we glad you, Coca-Cola. Yeah, we glad you noticed. You noticed we value diversity, and then under that is like all the death squads in South America they funded in the 2000s. And it's like that's capitalism, with that's just in the largest scale corporation.
Well, I was gonna say
what we really live in is. I'll stop cutting off. Go on.
Well, I was going to say, you know, I it's weird because I think like a lot of these sort of neoliberals, they think like, yeah, we can help people too while we do this neoliberalism thing. And I just don't think it works that way. So it's not like, I don't think they're conspiring. I think they believe in their own ideology, so to speak.
Like I said, it's like the real of capital does not require you to believe in it. That's Nick Land's point. Right. It simply doesn't. So if it's more advantageous to be anti-capitalist, you know, all the best capitalists will be anti-capitalists or whatever. But I mean, the whole idea of even positing an anti-capitalist subjectivity, you know, I don't even think that would be possible, because to move past the signifier of the vague abstract helping people, it's like it's important to help people. It never gets sort of more defined by that. And then it's back to representationalism. Oh, this person is really good. Oh, this person is really good. Oh, this person is really good. It's like, no, it's like, these are all agents of a system, and you have to adjust the system. And if you can adjust the system regarding insurance and regarding healthcare, then the agents will adjust as well. You know, you can't change people, or you just sort of, You throw them within a system and they operate within the real of the system, no matter what their sort of stated ideology is. Whether you have Biden, whether you have, you know, Warren, maybe Warren won't bomb something, but fucking Trump doesn't bomb something once in a while. You know, you throw someone into the president of the United States, it requires a substantial amount of willpower to break any sort of real flow, which is, you know, currently existing within, you know, the system where the U.S. government is essentially like, you know, a sort of half nanny, half like joke babysitter of the corporations, right? It's like we live in a corporation. We don't live in a society. We live in a corporation. But, you know, instead of corporations are people, my friend. Corporations are society, my friend. It's like that the idea that we have a government. We only have a government insofar as governments once in a while, you know, fund nonprofits, which are, you know, corporations, like, ultimately. And then, you know, one nonprofit versus the other nonprofit. Kaiser's a nonprofit. You know, speaking of mental health and really bad mental health practice, and the NUHW, who's a by the way, they're not officially a Trotskyist union, the NUHW, but the person who founded it was a Trotskyist. And I talk with them, and they're cool. They're cool. But it is very difficult because they, so say you have a communist representative of mental health workers, which exists in the NUHW to some extent, although a lot of people might disagree that they're Trotskyist, and they have to deal with a labor board. So just for the workers, and so the Kaiser workers, they wanted to strike because their clients are getting one session a month. Imagine like being suicidal and getting one therapy session a month or something. Terrible. So then they advocate and then they do like 1 day strikes or 2 day strikes. But ultimately, and that Kaiser's a nonprofit, and ultimately it's just very difficult to break that flow of capital unless you have this, you know, what Land, speaking of Land, would call like a despotic top-down solution. But that's not despotic. It's just like, it's a forcing of, it's like you have to take away the self-interest in terms of like, it can no longer be in the corporation's self-interest to generate capital. And if you can't do that, maybe you need something to replace the insurance system that currently exists. And I think that's the appeal of Bernie Sanders and, you know, single payer. And the whole idea of even just going to the doctor, it's like, oh, I could, like, imagine being able to go, oh, I could use some therapy. I'll just go down and get free therapy because my government provides free therapy. Oh, wouldn't that be fucking awful? The idea that it would be qualitatively different is bullshit. I can tell you right now, theory is fucking totally missed. I think it might qualitatively improve if you have governmental sort of oversight of mental health. I think there might be more focus on theory and newer sort of better practices would be able to be implemented in there. You know, I think in the NHS they have psychoanalysis covered by the government in some cases. So.
Oh, really?
That's what I've heard. So, yeah, in terms of, we're talking about, the insurance system, yeah, it's shit. It's why we're doing this, and it's very hard to change. We need a drastic, we need to simply declare war. I mean, it's like, there's no compromising with neoliberalism. It's like, we need to declare war, and we need to figure out how to beat it, if it's even possible to beat it. You know, that might be the, you know, that's the capitalist realism sneaking in, but it's like, in what sense can we truly break this system of just capital, the will of capital as the object of itself, you know, outside of neoliberal placeholders or whatever.
Well, I was going to wrap up by saying, you know, it was interesting when I was talking to Ben Burgess earlier in this episode. He brought up this whole debate about, oh, well, if we have a healthcare system that's more like Canada or, you know, like Britain with the NHS, you'll have to wait longer in line.
Ben Burgess really say that shit?
No, he was making fun of it.
Okay.
What he said,
I was like, no, he didn't say that. Because I've heard him, I know he's a sock dumb, but I was like, if he said that, I would. He didn't say that though, so it doesn't.
Right. What he said was like, think about how callous that argument is. Like, because what it's saying is, I have more money than these people, and they don't deserve care. I do because I have more money, and screw those people. If they have to die, then just let them, because I have the money to pay for my care, and they don't. And no one really thinks of it as being that callous, but it is. Ben's right about that.
Yeah, the idea that money is ethical substance, as Hegel stated, is sort of within the spirit of morality, whether or not we like it. That is pretty, it's callous, but it's also, it's such a deep ideological mechanism. It's like you almost can't fight the ideology. You just have to defeat the real of the system in terms of the fact that it just generates capital for itself. Like, if you're going to try to convince people logically that it's callous, it's like, well, sure. Yeah, it is. But it's good to hear Ben talk and Ben sort of present his very logical arguments. But ultimately, it's, you know, I sort of thought this to myself. It's like, he did logic for the left. How about, like, fucking effective propaganda for the left? Because people don't give a fuck about logic. I mean, we do. But, like, effective propaganda.
I mean, I'm a big fan of arguing for the fills. I know people say, like, facts over fills, but I'm like, no, the fills are good. That's what sort of gets to people. Like, we have to argue from the heart as well as the mind.
Yeah. I mean, good, solid arguments are, I think, important for when I, you know, for people to have. I think if your argument is bad, in terms of if the real of, like, the will to have a universalized healthcare is actually, like, self-contradictory and shitty, then that's bad if it's illogical. But I think it is intrinsically a logical demand in terms of the will to health and the will to a general health. So I think that's its own logic outside of people bringing that logic into their consciousness is like, it's sound. So universal healthcare is like sound. In that case, what's our task? Well, you know, to fuck the insurance companies. It's like, they're vicious, man. The people who run those things are fucking, they fucking hate social democracy in terms of they hate that notion of single payer. They think they're people who advocate for it are plebs and idiots. And, you know, I fucking hear them talk about their visceral hatred for Bernie Sanders. Like, the grasp of neoliberalism and the co-opting of the, you know, the boomer 60s pseudo leftism into your, you know, neoliberal landlordism is powerful. It's fucking powerful because it had a lot of energy to that movement and it's still sort of alive and feeding neoliberalism, and we need to destroy it. There's nothing else to, you know, logic for the left, great. Propaganda for the left, great. Let's do it all. Let's fucking throw it at this machine. Let's fucking kill it. Yeah, let's kill it and make something better. That's what I say.
Well, hey, Elliot, I want to thank you for coming on. Just real quick, maybe, how do you think we can maybe more effectively move towards health justice or overcome capitalist realism, I guess, in regards to these issues? And maybe also plug your works.
Plug my works. Okay. How do we overcome capitalist realism?
That's a big question.
you better have a better realism almost. That's sort of the direct, speaking of my works in terms of like what I'm saying is a very real, like if you could call it a realist argument. I feel like the latest thing I'm working on is how do you create a subjectivity with, you know, Hegel's theory of the subject, which is the subject is actually will embodied. And then how do you sort of go through this fragmentation that we're currently in because of technology and because of it, symbolic disintegration? Assuming that we can't reverse that course, how do we create a sort of singular, revolutionary sort of subject in terms of how do we become a revolutionary subject? And I think part of that is understanding what is involved, what sort of wills are involved, how they become their radical opposites, how people end up compromising the initial sort of will. So the idea is, how do we overcome capitalist realism? Is, well, in healthcare, I think it's just not giving up, one. Two, I would say just, you know, don't get depressed. Don't be let down. I think we have, like, you know, I think we're in the right place in terms of ideologically universal healthcare, so people don't have to have GoFundMes to replace their fucking spine. Hello, is a good cause, and we just keep plugging away. You know, we keep plugging away in terms of what we can do. Whether you're a logic professor like Ben, whether you're a therapist like me, whether you're you know, a podcast host like you. I don't think direct action and symbolic, you know, systemic changes are contradictory. And I think that's really important because there's this sort of anarchist socialist divide. And I think if you get rid of the signifiers, the socialist problem with anarchy is like reactionary sort of like, oh, here's a bad thing, and then I'm going to do an ideological response. But I think if you take a frank look at the situation you're in and the structure you're in, and you don't despair, because there's no need to despair, you know, quite frankly. But if you want to change a shitty system, if you want to destroy a shitty system, think about how you can do that. And think about how you can do that, say, like for me, by providing good client care, and how you can do it systemically by maybe, I don't know, unionize your workplace, which is actually more difficult. By the way, if you unionize your workplace, don't let the boss find out early. Fun fact. I fucking learned that lesson. Holy shit. Anyway, I could tell you more if it comes public with the labor board, but holy shit. All right. But yeah,
I wanted to ask you one more thing that just popped up into my head. How do you think we can reconcile sort of that Max Stirner egoism, you know, about the self with, you know, health justice? Because I guess a lot of people these days look at Stirner as being a right-wing figure, because there are sort of right-wing figures related to him. Okay, go ahead.
I would say I'm a Hegelian who's trying to do what Stirner was trying to do better. Or at least in terms of, I think I have a will, people have a will to health, and they have a will to health for the object of society, right? Be very frank about it. It's an egoistic interest in the symbolic order. Recognize the wills that are in conflict. People have a will to generate money. There's the will to capital accumulation. And you basically just have to be frank about that. I don't think there's anything anti-egoic. I even talk about, the very first thing I'm talking about is a sort of will to peace, which is one of the hardest things to overcome, ironically, in terms of like to still feed that will for peace. But in terms of, like, you can look at Kant and his sort of system as a will to peace. This is universal peace. And said, Hegel said, no, even better, you could just do what the government says. And that fulfills that will to peace even better. But it's sort of understanding what motivates people. People have to be they have to have a good case that it's sort of in their, you know, that will has to be cultivated, the will to destroy an unjust system and to give birth to a new one, like a phoenix. that's what has to be cultivated. That might sound poetic, or like in terms of poetic as garbage propaganda, but I think quite frankly it gets to the heart of it. You have to cultivate that will to destroy and be reborn in terms of egoically. And that's will, that's desire, you know. That's the you know, you have to cultivate that desire. I don't think that is not at all in conflict with socialist goals. And in fact, you know, I'm a socialist, communist type, but ultimately, like, I would say an egoist anarchist, because I posit that you need your own sort of system of right, in terms of a state will never have, like, the full right. So I would say you're de facto an anarchist if you are sort of willing to be totally contra the state in any sort of situation. But
can I add something to that? I was going to say, so I think in a lot of ways what I'm hearing is, you know, there's even a will to community, a will to altruism, and it becomes sort of a strange loop, because when we act altruistically and we care about our neighbors, it benefits us as well. So the more we do for our community, the more it benefits us.
But here's the thing, and this is what I write about in the book, and it's very much a positive feedback process, which is why I'm very excited about it. I keep telling people, I'm like, you know, I'm writing a book. I already told you, you know, I'm writing a book that'll be around for a couple hundred years at least, right? Because, like you said, the altruism, when the will to altruism is created, you can feed that into itself and become an altruistic subject. That's what Hegel is sort of dismissing by his limiting that to the right subject. So that's what Hegel is missing in terms of right subjectivity. He tries to create a single subjectivity, but you have the power to be an altruistic subject. You have the power to be a socialist subject. And that's egoism. It's psychological egoism, in terms of you cannot escape self-interest. You can have your various wills sort of flowing all over the place, but you can be determined and become a subjectivity of, you know, of the phoenix subjectivity to destroy what is bad and to create what is good, you know. And if you have a will to peace where you want to do that nonviolently, more power to you, you know. I'm with you in the Bernie Sanders rally playing the 60s jam bands, you know. I'm just, so it's, yeah, I think people, egoism and socialism already, insofar as they already can go together, it can be, you know, that will process can be really fed back. And it, I think you yourself can sort of posit more, right? That's what I like about it.
Well, hey, Elliot, I want to thank you again for coming on this Parallax Views fundraiser. Let's try to destroy this system where we have to start GoFundMe pages for someone who is paralyzed, who was in a freak accident. I want to kick some ass right now.
Yeah, exactly. Fuck it. Let's destroy it and build something better.
Next up, a conversation with Jeremy Salmon of the Giving the Mic to the Wrong Person podcast. If you haven't heard Giving the Mic to the Wrong Person, well, I've made an appearance on it. It's a rather fun podcast that combines DSA politics with Jeremy and his friends' love of, well, nerdery. In other words, sci-fi, The X-Files, Dungeons and Dragons, and other favorites of pop culture obsessives. So let's nerd out with Jeremy Salmon of Giving the Mic to the Wrong Person.
Welcome to Parallax Views, Jeremy Salmon of Giving the Mic to the Wrong Person, a sort of podcast that traverses DSA politics, I guess, and also a sort of sci-fi fantasy nerdery, but in a good way, not in the sort of Vox Dei far-right sci-fi fantasy world way. how are you doing tonight?
Oh, hello there. Hey, everybody, how you doing? This is Jeremy. Yeah, the tagline for the show that I use it, describe it as is socialism and Simpsons quotes, Posadism and pro wrestling. So it's kind of we kind of run the gamut. But mainly, yes, it's a lot because I am an active DSA member out of the Portland chapter. And this is a lot of stuff that my headspace is in already. And it's kind of a thing where, hey, it's my show and let's talk about this stuff. So it's the show itself is we'll do everything. For, I mean, it started 3 years ago because I wanted to do like a show about, you know, about nerd shit, but that wasn't just, you know, video games and superheroes and vampires and zombies and Star Wars. Because if you're an American geek, you can only be a geek if you consume certain properties that are owned by multinational media megacorps. I wanted to vary it up, and then 2016 kind of radicalized a lot of people, myself included, and so the next year we kind of started mixing in a lot more politics. And so now we'll do things like we had episodes just like on basic theory, like here, Socialist Feminism 101, and we'll have, you know, folks on from my chapter or other people that I know here in Portland to talk about it. Or we had an episode on, like, you know, organizing a tenants union. We've talked to like, you know, the first ever political candidate for a state office that was ever endorsed by the Portland DSA chapter. And then there are episodes where we will drink too much and talk about Pet Sematary for 2 hours. That kind of a thing.
The original or the remake?
Right. It would be the original because it was before we saw the remake. I think we recorded this like way back in like October. And right before the trailer for the remake hit, I think. It was one of those ones, because I always had the idea that I wanted to do a if I was ever going to do a rewatch podcast, it would be one that we just watched the worst cinematic adaptations of Stephen King novels. And the fun bit is because it's because of the cultural production that is the Stephen King industry, you know. We would never run out.
Well, you know, I wanted to have you on because this is the unexpected part three of the Parallax Views Health Justice Fundraiser. We're raising funds for a family. They're sort of split across Pittsburgh on one end and then Florida in the next end. But they're a very tight-knit family despite being in two different states. And their father recently suffered a fractured C7, so the spine. And, you know...
That's rough.
What was that?
I was just saying, that's rough. But yeah, no, go. Please go. Please continue.
Yeah, well, I mean, paralyzed from the chest down since this accident in March of this year. And his Medicare days have run out, but he still needs 24/7 inpatient care. He still needs that rehab time. And, I mean, it's a rough situation and one that sort of horrifies me in general, because it's indicative of the sort of just mess we're in with the healthcare system in this country. I mean, we're told that Obamacare and, or, you know, ACA, because I feel like Obamacare was sort of a right-wing slur for it, but there is definite criticism to be made of ACA, but I'm starting to ramble.
Yeah.
So what do you think of the sort of healthcare system in America and, you know, this concept of what Tim Faust calls health justice now?
Let's see, thoughts are, well, let's see, if you have not heard, or seen Tim Faust speak, there are several videos, both on YouTube. In fact, we even had a brief interview with him last year, and I even posted the audio of a talk that he gave, because he's been on this kind of like, it's been about 2 years he's been doing this kind of barnstorming, you know, kind of national tour of just going around and just talking about healthcare and the need for, you know, kind of single payer and beyond, and ultimately, yeah, about the idea of like health justice, about the idea that what determines our health isn't just, you know, what happens inside of a hospital or what you go to see a doctor for. It's kind of a thing where he talks about how, like, you know, that, you know, dealing with housing is health justice, dealing with work is health justice, dealing with food is health justice. And, you know, I could go on, but in fact, we even recently interviewed him. We did a little roundtable. In fact, earlier this week, did a roundtable discussion with local kind of like Medicare for All and single payer advocates in here in Portland, and had him on the line to talk about his book and his work. Tim has he's got a great line. There's a great term in the book that he says that I think someone in the disability advocacy community mentioned to him called it being temporarily able-bodied, because that's as the defining quality for, you know, most of our lives, is that everybody is temporarily able-bodied, but at some point we all get sick, and eventually we all at some point will require more care for ourselves than we can provide.
That's why I've never understood people who, like, make fun of the disabled, because I've always said to people that do that kind of thing, I'm like, you realize we're all going to be disabled in the end. Like, you're going to get old. More or less, you're going to be disabled in some way just because of the tyranny of aging.
Yeah.
I was gonna add, though, Tim is like one of these characters. I really dig what he's doing, especially some of the videos he did for Means TV. Shout out to them. Everyone needs to check out Means TV. Street Fight Radio is also there. They were a recent guest on our show. But, you know, Tim is sort of like, you know, he's this metalhead sort of guy that's talking about healthcare. He's driving around the country lecturing to different communities about healthcare problems in those communities. And I don't know, between him and, like, maybe Barrett Brown, who I've had on my podcast, I feel like those two guys are like the last remaining gonzo journalists in our country, and we need more gonzos. You know, we need to keep the Hunter S. Thompson spirit alive.
Only hopefully not as kind of, hopefully they don't, I think you can kind of describe Hunter S. Thompson as effectively blackpilling himself by the end there, wasn't he?
That's probably true. I mean, I will always have a soft spot for Hunter S. Thompson, even if he may have been problematic in some ways.
Yeah, there. Tim's tour. I believe it's starting around late August and going through September, where he's swinging across the USA, and I think he's got a really he's got a cool tour poster. I think this tour is called Hellbent for Healthcare, with a skeleton wearing an OR scrubs and doing a sick trick on a skateboard with a snake. It's if you get a chance, check it out when it comes to your town. If you hopefully if you check the notes for this, there'll be a link to the tour there. But if you just Google, Timothy Faust Health Justice Tour, you'll find it. He is a very compelling speaker. His book that is just now coming out. He's going to be on a speaking and book tour. Is called Health. What is it? Health Justice Now. Yeah, what is the actual? What is the full part? Wait, hang on a sec. I want to get this right. What is the full name of the book?
Health Justice Now: Single Payer and What Comes Next.
Yeah, it is it's a marvelous book. It's as a couple of the people we had, who are like local DSA members attached to our Medicare for All campaign, have talked about. They were searching for us like a single volume, a book that really details everything of, like, not only how bad things are right now, but what the kind of Medicare for All plan would be, the ones that are currently in the House and the Senate, and as well as but how to expand that into something more. Tim's book has like the fourth section, because like his book is divided up into sections. The first one is pretty much what is. The second part is single payer, what it should be. And then the third part is expanding to what can be, and the fourth part is kind of a collection of people's stories that he's talked to. It was everywhere he goes, like people flock to him. He'll just hear the stories of how people have just gotten really screwed over and damaged horribly by the stupid system.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, I think my own personal experience with American healthcare as it is I've been mostly lucky in that, because my parents were unionized high school teachers, so I got to be on their healthcare and their health insurance until I turned 26 or something.
Can I comment on that?
Go for it.
It's funny, I don't think I told you before we started recording, but the person we're doing the fundraiser for is actually a ninth grade algebra teacher.
Yeah.
And I mean, it just blows my mind. I keep saying throughout this fundraiser, I'm not one of those people that thinks healthcare should be only for like one class of people. I don't think it should just be for people who contributed to the community in the way that we want them to, yada, yada, yada. But
yeah,
the fact that he... Go ahead.
I say, yeah, universal.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but the fact that he played by the rules, contributed to his community, he went way out of his way for a lot of students, from my understanding, and he still can't get the care he needs. I mean, it blows my mind. So I just wanted to add that in there, since you mentioned your parents being high school teachers.
Mm-hmm. And, but just to go back to finish up with my story, it's fairly fortunate. Haven't had any real major health scares aside from probably ones that involve beer, maybe. I don't know. But I think one of the things that I have had to deal with is because I've done a lot of like contract and temp jobs, which always have just kind of, like I said, pretty close to the whenever you hear, healthcare, health insurance in name only, where, I mean, yeah, it's kind of a thing you can kind of pay into, but the deductibles are high and the copays are just idiotic. One of the things that I'm dealing with now is that my is because, you know, I have like, you know, big prescription meds, and I need to, let's see, the only way I can really get a discount on them is that if I have to like kind of like bulk order them from the company that my health insurance provider has kind of handpicked as supplying them. The problem being is that one of those meds, because it is on a schedule, means that it can't be ordered in bulk and sent through the mail. You know, I have to go, I kind of have to, you know, go up and get refilled at the local pharmacy once a month at not too much a discount. So it's still like, okay, great. I have healthcare, quote unquote, and I'm still paying a pretty penny for this stuff. I mean, it's fortunately, it's nowhere near as bad as, you know, like I said, some of the horror stories where you hear like people, like, everything from like, you know, insulin to EpiPens, where they just jack the price up, you know, but three or four, you know, I don't know how many 100% over just like the last 5 years alone.
You ever seen the movie The Wicker Man? I know that's really off topic. I have a reason.
Both versions, and also we went and saw Midsommar earlier this year, which the director apparently claims is not referencing Wicker Man, which is hilariously, you know, bullshit, because there are more than a few explicit references to the Wicker Man in that film. But yes, I have seen the film.
Well, it's interesting because I actually ended up bringing up the Wicker Man on part two of our fundraiser, because I had the good folks at the Horror Vanguard podcast on for it. And we were talking about horror movies and how some of them deal with sort of medical horror and, you know, the horror of the sort of healthcare crisis in this country.
Yeah, almost like Cronenberg stuff too.
Right, right. But it's funny because at the end of that conversation, I actually said, you know, somehow Wicker Man came up. I think it was through Midsommar. And I said, you know, I'm imagining Pharma Bro, Martin Shkreli, you know, in the Wicker Man while we're all dancing like happy pagans as he's burning in the Wicker Man. Because he was the one that jacked the prices up on HIV meds.
Yeah, Tim gets into this particular story in his book. That is not the reason why he got snagged. He got snagged because he defrauded the wrong people.
Oh, really? Oh,
and because he fucked with rich people, not because he jacked up like I said, what he did was effectively legal for, like, you know, the medical shit. But what got him in trouble was some of the other stuff that was, I think, I don't remember the details of the case, but it was pretty much, you know, pretty much borderline. And, you know, I need a way to, you know, to say if I was going to do this, let's say edit in a newscaster describing the case here. But what he did was effectively like defrauding some rich people. And that got, because if it affects rich people, then that's finally how he got stopped. He got, you know, the problem that he was addressed.
That's funny because that's the same story with Bernie Madoff that people forget about. Madoff only got, you know, caught because he screwed with the wrong people. If it was anyone else, he would have been, you know, untouched.
Yeah, funny how that works.
Indeed, indeed. But go on, tell me a little bit more about Tim's work. I know he's been very busy. I've been wanting to get him on, but it's, you know, he's on tour and it's been a very crazy time, I guess, promoting his work and talking to these communities.
Yeah, but like I said, it's kind of things where, folks, if you have not, if you haven't read anything that he's written or the kind of like heard him speak, please, like I said, hit up YouTube. You can either, if you go to the SoundCloud page for my own podcast and look back a year ago, I posted the audio from his talk in Portland, and it's a hell of a thing. It's kind of a thing where it will lay a lot of things bare, but also it can give you hope as to, like, you know, all right, finally someone is naming what needs to be done and how things need to expand, like, you know, how, and also, you know, how we need to, you know, make sure that, say, like, disability rights and trans rights and trans services are part of, you know, a proper single player plan. Because otherwise, if you leave certain people out, then it's not truly universal care. So, like, you know, everybody on board.
You know, it's funny you brought up the EpiPen scandal, because I completely forgot about that and have somehow not mentioned it this whole fundraiser.
The it's hilariously emblematic, illustrative. I can't whatever word works for there of our particular moment in time in political economy, because who was the CEO of the company that jacked up the price? Do you remember?
I think the owner was Mylan NV. Mm-hmm. And the CEO of Mylan NV was Heather Bresch.
Right. Now, who's Heather Bresch's father?
I do not know, actually.
Let me double check this just to make sure. You'll enjoy this if I can get this. Let me double check this. I just, because I'm not gonna, I don't want to ruin a punchline by getting it wrong. Yep. The CEO of Mylan, Heather Bresch, she's the daughter of someone. She's the daughter of Joe Manchin.
Oh my God, the United States Senator, West Virginia, yes. Right? Okay.
Yes. And who, funnily, you know, how the contributions of certain members of the executive board of Mylan, you know, whose political campaigns those go towards. But anyway, but it's one of those things where it's one of those examples of like kind of you see online of like the people who say like, you know, vote blue no matter who, and you know, who freak out about how, you know, hey, we can't argue about, you know, we have to go for the most electable person in the primaries, and why do we have primaries whatsoever? And it's like, you know, Joe Manchin's kind of the example of like, yeah, this is what happens when they go bad.
Well, you know, it's a lot like the whole thing with that Twitter user, Horse Whisperer, who, you know, everyone's talking about. Oh, yeah, the horse account.
Yep.
Yeah, and I'm like, first off, why are we mentioning some random Twitter user who, you know, I'm fine with people using pseudonyms, but that's like such a bizarre pseudonym, and it seems like a lot of it is like it's an unrealistic name to use. And I don't see why we have to have that mention on MSNBC. And then it comes out, of course, that I guess he is a marketing guy. He's marketed for like military weapons people and big pharma. Of course.
Yeah, funny how that works. But you know, but it's one of those things where it's like the reasons why they would include him are not necessarily, you know, deliberately nefarious, but it's almost like there's a class chauvinism, because you know, you have media people tend to be upper middle class professionals and look out for their own. And but also kind of like so deep into the ideology that they don't realize that that's what they're doing. Anyway, but we are slightly off topic. So yeah, healthcare, American healthcare sucks. and you'll find many terrible. Like I said, at some point, it's, you know, it's like, I don't even, it's like bad faith act. That's the fun thing about ideology. It's like, I don't know how many of these people are either like arguing in bad faith or disingenuous, because there are so many people out there who are true fucking believers that, you know, that this is the only way possible, is that we can't, you know, some sort of Joe Biden shit that, you know, I can't, you know, my, you know, the memory of my son, is why, I'm, you know, that I can't go for Medicare for all.
The healthcare situation in this country is just, you know, beyond the pale. You know, since you organized with the DSA, maybe you could tell my listeners, I'm not sure I've really mentioned the DSA much on my show. How would you describe the DSA, what it really is, as opposed to maybe what a Tucker Carlson would say it is, and what their view on healthcare would be?
I can talk about what I like about our local chapter here in Portland, that I think at least on the whole, we have a relatively healthy culture. Of course, the word relatively is kind of, you know, it's kind of implying a lot, I guess. You know, plenty of tenancies, plenty of, you know, work together, but, you know, plenty of projects to do. Going out and joining an organization like leftist, like, you know, like your local chapter there of DSA or anything else is kind of, it is, I know it's at least helped me kind of like stave the horrors away that kind of modernity brings on, because it's, you see, especially, it's always online now, isn't it? But like so many people who they don't have that avenue to like actively work towards something to apply themselves. And it's kind of like the only way that they know about how to do politics is just to, you know, phone bank, vote, donate, and watch MSNBC. And like that's all they and you know, post howling into the void. And, you know, recent history has shown that that's not enough. You have to get out there and do more. And at least getting involved in a group has, I think, just greatly, you know, we've done some good, we've gotten some good stuff passed, hopefully done some decent political education, we've launched 1,000 podcasts, got a couple, Portland DSA now has a couple endorsed candidates for both state and national office campaigns are formed behind, yeah.
Well, I was going to say, you know, my basic impression is that the DSA and the sort of left wing of the possible in America, as Michael Harrington once put it, is sort of pushing against the privateers when it comes to healthcare and other issues. One of the strangest things to me about what has happened to this country in the past few decades is, you know, the word innovation? It's basically now like this code word for like only the private sector can like do anything useful. I always hear that with people. Go on.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say to innovate. You always got to innovate, 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 innovate. There's a book. I have a book somewhere by Scott Berkun, Berkun, called Innovation is a Myth. That I think is kind of a collection of stuff, but it's one of those things that gets into like, we can do a whole other episode about tech culture too. And like just the weird, bizarre, levels of, you know, they live type ideology that goes on there. But yeah, it's a hell of a thing, but yeah, innovation, because it doesn't actually, the way that innovation actually happens is not in the way that because a lot of people in media, especially like tech media, are much like with like video, similar, at least people who get into like video games journalism openly admit that they are kind of the enthusiast press. And so much of media talking about, you know, either entrepreneurs or tech culture are just kind of, you know, just clueless cheerleaders of really rich guys and believing everything that they're told.
Well, that's at best. I mean, there's a reason I brought up the innovation thing. And it's because, you know, people can make fun of, like, Al Gore all they want, and he probably deserves it. I'm not, like, a big fan of his. But the whole, like, Al Gore said he invented the internet. Yeah, well, what people don't, like, tell you, and I'm going to, like, curse for a second here. What people don't fucking tell you is that, you know, the tech community doesn't exist without government R&D anyways. Research and development. So yeah, the internet probably wouldn't fucking come into existence if it wasn't for R&D. And that goes for a fucking lot of things. I mean, a lot of the advancements we've made are because of the public sector. And, you know, the fact that people think we can't have a robust public sector because everyone's afraid of quote-unquote welfare queens, you know, which is really, to me, code speak. When people like Roger Stone say that, I think they're talking about, you know, race in a lot of ways with that, and it's offensive as all get out.
Oh yeah, but explicit. Like I said, the original welfare queen was white. That's the bit that somehow never got translated in all of the bullshit Reagan talk, wasn't it?
Yeah. And it's just like this idea that even like today FDR would be looked at as like some hyper radical. And FDR was just like a reformist that was trying to save capitalism from itself, ultimately. He wasn't even like that far to the left. But even now, that's considered far left. I mean, how far have we come as a country where the idea that the public sector can do some good, that public infrastructure can be good, especially in something like healthcare. Oh, God forbid we do any of that. Let's give all the private insurance companies all the power in the world. I mean, we've gone to the height of absolute insanity. It's peak madness.
Ideology is a hell of a drug. Oh, also propaganda works too. And I think a lot of people kind of forget that part.
Well, before you go, I wanted to get your takes since you cover some sci-fi stuff, some pro wrestling and whatnot on your podcast. It's interesting. I know a lot of pro wrestlers on the indie circuit wish they could, like, unionize wrestling, especially for healthcare. People like Daphne, I believe her name is Unger. She used to work for WCW, has talked about that. And, you know, sci-fi, of course, ties into this as well because, I mean, sci-fi is all about utopian futures a lot of times or dystopian futures. So how would you tie healthcare into some of the topics that are quote unquote nerdy like sci-fi or pro wrestling and you know, especially sci-fi, I think.
Well, I can give you a direct connection between pro wrestling, sci-fi and unionization. Do you know the wrestler who was the major proponent of organizing the WWF in the 80s?
Jesse Ventura. And I know what you're going to mention. You're going to mention a movie called Abraxas, Guardian of the Galaxy.
That, and also he was in a film where he was in the film that kind of that prototyped deep fakes in The Running Man.
Yes, that's true. So he was in a bunch of sci-fi stuff.
Yeah,
Predator, Demolition Man.
He's in Demolition Man. He's one of the Men in Black on the X-Files in one of the Darren Morgan episodes that also features Alex Trebek as a Men in Black without a mustache, and he looks really creepy. I think one of the a good person to talk to and a good person to read about this is Peter Fraze. Check out his book that was published by, I think it was kind of a cross-publishing by Jacobin and Verso a couple years ago called Four Futures, Life After Capitalism. And he kind of spells out, he uses four different kind of sci-fi properties or speculative fiction properties to kind of, you know, go off like how could we possibly go, you know, whether we'd be going between either, you know, very, you know, kind of like a very hierarchical or very egalitarian or scarcity or post-scarcity and kind of like, and so the four examples that he uses for, you know, egalitarian and post-scarcity, you have Star Trek. For egalitarian but full-on scarcity, you have the 1975 book Ecotopia, which is an interesting novel and hell of a mid-70s artifact. Also has the interesting – also a plot point of that particular book is that Cascadia as a breakaway republic is a thing, which I always thought was amusing. But also the other couple of possible futures are one that is extremely – it's post-scarcity, but it's completely hierarchical, which is Elysium, where you have the you have like kind of like reinforced class society. And then the last but not least, which is kind of like scarcity, but also hierarchical and just full on just exterminationist, which is just Mad Max. And it's kind of like four different ways of viewing, like, of what kind of a world do you want to build? What kind of world are we building without knowing it? But also that, as he puts out of the book, it is very highly likely that we will have to go through one of those to get to another, which, if you know your Star Trek, is exactly what happened.
Well, it's interesting, too, because I remember he says in that book that we're probably living in a mix of all of them right now way or another. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we are recording this on a continent that already had mass die-offs and mass genocide. Only it happened about 200-300 years ago. Which, you know, between 300 and 500 years ago, there were, you know, like I said, just mass die-offs and mass genocide.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've always been more of a horror guy, and it was funny because I mentioned the horror vanguard. We were talking about horror movies and healthcare, and I the only movie that comes to mind that really sort of dealt with that was the Saw franchise.
Also, are you forgetting the classic that was Dr. Giggles?
Dr. Giggles is amazing, and somehow we forgot that. Tell us about Dr. Giggles for people who haven't seen it.
Oh God, I barely remember. All I remember about Dr. Giggles is because I remember the VHS box that was at the video, that was, you'd see at the video store, because it was memorable, and it starred the titular character was Larry Drake,
a brilliant actor. When I went to L.A., he's buried at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, and I went to see his tombstone or whatever. I was like, he's such a great actor, great character actor.
And I only knew him about because I was a big fan of Darkman, and he's the antagonist in Darkman. And then it turns out, you know, the next thing the next year he makes this thing. So it's like, okay, we'll check this out. But yeah, horror and medical. And then you also have, did you bring up Dead Ringers?
Dead Ringers, I did not get to mention either. Now you're, damn, you outdid Horror Vanguard.
horror was not really my chosen genre. Horror comedy, however, is much more my wheelhouse. But no, growing up, I was always much more, especially because my dad my dad, who was always into stuff like, you know, grew up reading sci-fi, you know, was into UFOs and kind of a lot of stuff. And me being of the age where Star Trek, Star Wars, and classic space Legos were kind of core fundamentals to my, you know, to the fact that I would, you know, later go on to, I attended space camp as a teenager and went on to get degrees in aerospace and electrical engineering. So sci-fi was always my thing, and horror was something I never really got into because I think I was always had a very hyperactive imagination growing up, and I was always, it was more of the thing of I was scared of being scared, so I never really got into horror. It wasn't really until later that, especially once I discovered horror comedy, that things kind of we're flowing from that.
Yeah, horror comedies are great. The reason though that I mentioned Saw was because I'm not a big fan of the Saw movies, but I'm still sympathetic to the Tobin Bell character, and it's so much that, I mean, he just loses it because he can't get his treatment, and then he terrorizes the health insurance guy over it. I'm like, yeah, the health insurance guy probably deserved that. You know, Tobin Bell did nothing wrong.
There you go. There's your sample to clip out in the promo reel you make for your show.
Well, hey, I guess in closing, do you think we'll get any anywhere in regards to Medicare for All? Do you think the healthcare system will change in America? And any parting thoughts on what we're doing with this fundraiser?
I think the fundraiser is great. I think it's unfortunately necessary. It is kind of...
it's appalling that anyone should have to do a GoFundMe.
Yeah.
Just to raise funds for their medical expenses. I mean, it's beyond me. It's disgusting.
Yeah, and it's kind of like... Yeah, and it's some of the things like, yeah, someone... talking about, profiting off the misery of others. People are, you know, certain people are making money off of, because GoFundMes take like what, like 2% out or something. There's some minor percent they do take out, and that goes directly into the pockets. And one of the people whose pockets it might go into might just be on a podcast that isn't exactly, that's a political podcast, favored by hashtag resistance types, that might not be as vociferously in support of Medicare for All as one would hope. But that's an issue for another day. As for are we going to win this thing, I think some folks are going to or will literally die trying. How about that? In terms of, you know, like I said, the fight, you know, the fight never ends. But it's one of those things where, I mean, Jesus, just look at how things have changed in the last 2-3 years where, you know, just saying Medicare for All was kind of like this weird outsider thing. Now it becomes... hey, you know, who knew that sometimes these counter-hegemonic moves can become effective and create the new standard? Those of you hearing this, more than likely you have local groups who are organizing from this thing, whether, you know, the nurses in California or, you know, like I said, local DSA or, you know, folks all over the place, or even like, you know, kind of like, I think the Poor People's Campaign is working on this too. But there's, like I said, it's one of those things that it's a fight that we need to fight, and it's something that you do need to fight for. That's that's kind of one of the lessons that we've learned in this very modern era, is that the political habits of the last 4 or 5 decades, you know, like just the mass demobilization and mass depoliticization of people and culture have kind of led us to this part. And, you know, it's kind of a thing where now, yeah, you have to go out far, and you got to, you know, as Angela Davis says in the title of her book from a couple years ago, freedom is a constant struggle.
Well, hey, I know it's late. I think we're both, you know, I've been burning the midnight oil for this fundraiser the past few days. Very frantic. Like I said, though, I'm kind of gonzo about things. I try to follow in the Hunter S. Thompson footsteps, except for the final years. But yeah,
hopefully, just as long as you don't have that you don't involve firearms as much.
Right, right, and don't become a Clinton supporter necessarily. But hey, Jeremy, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. How can listeners, you know, I've been trying to avoid plugging stuff too much for the fundraiser, but how can listeners find out about giving the mic to the wrong person?
We do have a couple relevant. We have actually recorded some episodes about. One will be coming up soon where we talk to. Like I said, a panel discussion of local kind of organizers and activists working on health justice, and all that we involved Tim Faust himself in. That one will be posting. I'm hoping it will be posting in September. No, it's actually, yeah, that one will be out within before mid-September. We also have a couple episodes that we've talked about before, where we've talked to members of DSA who are working on Medicare for All, and talked to Tim, and you know, there you can hear the talk that he gave in Portland last year on our show. You can find the podcast at soundcloud.com/givingthemic. We're on iTunes. I have a badly updated YouTube channel that's pretty much just our podcast that's up there. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/givingthemic. I'd throw it. You know, I don't want to mention. I won't mention the Patreon link because this is a fundraiser for some other people. So ignore, you know, cut that bit. But soundcloud.com/givingthemic. If you would like to hear more about a mix of kind of like leftist political topics with a particular bent of pop culture thrown in, and probably more. If you're of a certain age, you can't help but think in terms of Simpsons quotes. So this is the show for you.
Well, hey, thanks again, Jeremy, for coming on this Parallax Views fundraiser.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Hope the fundraiser is successful, and he gets the care he needs. And I hope that one day we are able to get to a point where we don't need fucking crowdfunding just for someone to stay alive.
And finally, a conversation with Jeremy's friend Rachel, who has some things to say about the healthcare system in America as a social worker at a crisis hotline. I can't add much beyond that because before this conversation, I didn't really know Rachel that well except through Jeremy. So with that in mind, why don't we just jump right into the conversation with Rachel?
Welcome to Parallax Views, Rachel. This is going to be an interesting conversation. I wanted to have you on because you have some experience with social work and as such healthcare in a way. We're doing this for a fundraiser. And I wanted to just get your thoughts on healthcare. Welcome to the show, Rachel.
Yes, thank you. One thing that's really struck me in the years I've worked in social work, which has been a little over a decade, not only how inhumane the healthcare system is, but how inefficient and illogical it is. The fact that you can't just go to any doctor that there are all these restrictions based on what kind of coverage you have, if you even have coverage. I started out my social work career working at a community mental health center in Maine, and most of the people I worked with had Maine Care, which is the state Medicaid program. Of course, people often were afraid of losing their coverage. Often people will get a job and they would lose their coverage, so you're kind of being punished for working, and then they couldn't actually afford insurance any other way. So one of the many ways that our system is so ridiculous and backwards. One other major issue was there were only four dentists in the state that took Maine Care. A lot of doctors will refuse to see people on Medicaid because the reimbursement rates are too low, or because they feel it's too inefficient, or whatever reason, which I think is completely discriminatory. I don't see how that's any less discriminatory than refusing to see people based on their race or religion or sexual orientation. So there were only four dentists in the state of Maine that took Maine Care. So even if people had coverage, they would be on these huge waiting lists. And obviously, if you don't get in to see the dentist, the problems get worse. The dental issues get worse. I mean, there were a lot of people there. I mean, I worked with people who would be, you know, 30 and missing half their teeth. It was really, really sad. And the issues would just keep getting worse while they're sitting there waiting on a waiting list to find a dentist who would see them. And then they might have to travel 3 hours. It was just absurd. And that's just one of a million examples I could give.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I know even in countries with, you know, presumably better healthcare options, like, for instance, in Australia, I know there's ways for dental and mental health services to sort of get out of the loop on providing the same amounts of care.
Yes. Yes, that's also the fact that dental, vision, and mental health are all treated as these kind of superfluous issues. That doesn't make any sense either, especially with all of the research showing the link between dental problems and other medical issues. And of course, with mental health, the fact that, the fact that mental health is care is so hard to find. And a lot of people I talk to on the crisis line, if they're within a managed care system, they have to stay within that system, even if they're extremely unhappy with the care they're getting through that system. Their choices are either to stay within that system or pay an extra out-of-network fee, or sometimes just have to pay completely out-of-pocket. And it's just one of many reasons that the free market system does not work in healthcare, because it's like, if I go to a restaurant and I have a lousy meal and the service is lousy and I decide not to eat there, I can just decide not to eat there. But, you know, if you're within a managed care system and you are unhappy with the service, you still have to stay within that system. It's just not, it doesn't work in the same way. And a lot of these insurance companies are just, they just seem to be gatekeeping and trying to restrict the services people get as much as possible.
It's interesting to me. I know you said you worked at a crisis line. I feel like a lot of people would be in better condition, even just mental health wise, if they didn't have to worry about, should I go to see my doctor or not?
Yes.
There are people that literally worry about whether they should see their doctor for financial reasons.
Absolutely. Yes, and I mean, even in case of emergency, there was a story in the Boston Globe a few months ago about a woman who I think fell onto the train tracks in Boston I don't remember exactly what happened, but something really horrific happened, and she was seriously injured, and people were calling 911, and she was yelling at them that she couldn't afford the ambulance. It's like, what kind of a system do we have? we get that a lot on the crisis line. People who are they lose their health coverage, and then even if they are lucky enough to have any other kind of coverage, they have to switch providers, or they're just losing their coverage, or in danger of losing their coverage, or they're not sure if they're still eligible for Oregon Health Plan, or it just causes huge amounts of anxiety. And then when people have to change providers because of their insurance or lose their services because of their insurance, yes, it causes enormous amounts of anxiety, not to mention if they have outstanding medical bills. It takes a huge toll on people's mental health. And I mean, and there are I do work for a crisis line, and there are people who, people who are suicidal or who have died by suicide who attribute that as a major factor, the outstanding medical bills or difficulty in accessing the care they need.
If you can answer this, I don't know if we've been sharing a lot of personal experiences on this fundraiser. I don't know if you have any personal experiences with the healthcare system or with what you've seen in regards to your social work and how the healthcare system sort of treats people.
Yes, a lot of different things. I think definitely there's this very tiered system. If you are on Medicaid, you're really treated as less than and given, I think, often inferior care. Not that private insurance is necessarily any picnic either. But yes, I mean, I'm fortunate in that I personally have never had to go uninsured, but yes, my employer had to very suddenly switch us to a different plan last year or the year before because of the cost of the plan, and it caused people, myself included, a huge amount of stress and anxiety. And it's just the whole system of linking health coverage to employment is insane, and the whole system of providers being in network or out of network is insane. The longer I work in this field, and the more both personal and professional experience I have, the more it's like, why can't you just go to any provider of your choosing and just have it be covered?
Well, what's weird to me is one of the things that keeps coming up is this fundraiser is specifically for a father who I keep using the word, he played by the rules. So he was a ninth grade algebra teacher. He gave back a lot to the community, would even help his students outside of class. If they were in trouble at home or if they needed tutoring, he would help out. And it's, I'm not one of these people that is like, oh, if you give back to your community more than this person, you deserve more care than that person. But I think it's indicative that someone who played by the rules still gets screwed over by the system.
Very much so. Very much so. And all kidding aside, people have said that, I don't know how familiar you are with the show Breaking Bad, but that character is very, he's very mixed bag morally and ethically, but it starts out, he's a high school teacher with a special needs kid and a pregnant wife, and he is at the beginning a very straight arrow who plays by the rules, and he gets cancer, and that's what leads him into selling meth out of desperation. And people have said that show couldn't exist in a country with universal healthcare, and it's just absurd that even could happen, that we've come to accept that.
Yeah, it's very weird how, I think sort of under the sort of neoliberal system we're in, a lot of blame is placed on individuals like, well, maybe you should have exercised more. Maybe you should go to yoga classes. And I'm like, that's such an insanely callous viewpoint to me.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yes, I know the CEO of Whole Foods wrote an editorial about that years ago. Yes, it's such a privileged viewpoint. And yeah, there are so many things wrong with that. For one thing, you can do all of those things and still end up with cancer or any other medical issue. And yeah, I mean, the idea that people who have, you know, made mistakes in life or haven't been completely virtuous that they're not deserving of care is absurd too. And yeah, and it makes it harder for people to do what, you know, when people can't get the care they need, that makes it so much harder for them to go to a job interview or to take care of their kids or do anything that they're, you know, quote unquote supposed to do.
And I guess starting to wrap up, the thing that has always struck me, you know, first I want to thank you for doing social work. I used to know people in college who wanted to get into social work, and other people would be like, you should get a business major like me or an advertising major. And I'm like, I don't know. You guys probably the advertisers should be paid less than the social workers in my world.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It seems like there's this idea that like if you're doing more virtuous work, quote unquote, you should just be so glad to be doing that work that you should accept a lower pay. It's such a backward system.
Or there's just an idea of like I know a lot of people that are like, well, everyone should just get into STEM. And I'm like, if everyone did that, there will be a shortage of jobs for STEM.
Exactly. And not everyone is, you know, some people are just more creative. Not everyone is into science and math, and that's fine, too.
You know, and I guess the other thing was, it's just weird to me that we're only sort of getting to this point now where people are taking Medicare for All much more seriously. I think the general populace has for a while. Last year, there was a survey by The Hill in D.C., a really respectable outlet that said, you know, 70% of Americans support Medicare for All. And yet we still have people like Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, who are, you know, very against the Medicare for All. I don't know if Buttigieg is. I would assume so. I know Beto O'Rourke isn't a fan. But
I think he said pretty watered down things like, oh, we're not ready for that, which, is beyond absurd.
You know, it's just weird to me because this is all coming to a head in a way now. But I mean, I almost feel like the fuse on this should have been lit a while ago. The EpiPen scandal, the pharma bro Martin Shkreli. I don't understand why it's taking so long. It's frustrating in a way.
Extremely. Yes, and I read an article recently saying how common it is for people with type 1 diabetes to die at age 26 or 27 shortly after they go off their parents' insurance, and then they can no longer afford insulin, so they're rationing it. And yeah, that just made me sick.
Well, I guess before we close out, do you think we will eventually get to this point where, you know, Medicare for All becomes policy? What are your thoughts on that and how we can sort of push for it?
I certainly hope so. That's encouraging that 70% of Americans support it. I know there's been some debate about whether this is something that should be done state by state or whether we should try to just have a national healthcare system, but it does seem that the reforms that have happened do tend to happen state by state, like with same-sex marriage or legalization of marijuana. So, and I know that Oregon has been a pioneer in so many things, like the death with dignity law, a lot of issues. So there does seem to be in Oregon a groundswell of support for a statewide single payer healthcare system. So I'd prefer we just all had universal single payer healthcare tomorrow, but I think it may have to happen state by state. That does seem to be how reforms seem to happen. And obviously I'm certainly hoping that Bernie will be elected, because he seems to be the only one who's really championed Medicare for All. At best, the other candidates either oppose it or give really watered down or kind of flip-flopping support for it.
Well, you know, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views for this health justice fundraiser. I guess the last thing I'll say, and then I'll let you have the last word, anything else you want to get out there, is, I mean, to me, it's just sort of a travesty of justice that we even have to do a GoFundMe for healthcare, for someone's healthcare. It's that's bizarre world. It's like something out of Black Mirror.
Yes, exactly. It's very dystopian.
Is there anything though that you want to add, just from your experience at the crisis line or doing social work, in regards to this topic? Any special insights?
Well, I think people often portray suicide as a mental health issue, and I'm not saying it's not, but I think people often overlook how much societal factors contribute to people being suicidal. You know, when people are afraid of becoming homeless or have become homeless, or they're losing their health care or can't get the coverage they need. Those are huge risk factors to suicide. I hear people say that all the time. So I think it's not that it is not also, there aren't also individual factors at play and mental health factors at play, but suicide is not just a mental health issue. It's also a societal issue.
Well, hey, Rachel, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views for this fundraiser. It's really meant a lot that you and Jeremy, from giving the mic to the wrong person, could help out with this.
Yes, well, thank you, and good luck. I wish we lived in a society where we didn't have to do GoFundMes for people, but I hope that it is successful. I hope your friend recovers well. So thank you so much for doing this work.
Well, that concludes our previously unpublished material from the Parallax Views Health Justice Fundraiser series. As noted at the beginning of the podcast, the GoFundMe for the family this fundraiser was done on behalf of is still ongoing. They've raised over $17,000 of the $40,000 goal, but they could still use your help. So please consider donating to that GoFundMe page, which I've linked to in the episode synopsis. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.